Today on the 21st, there was a surge in gun permit applications earlier this month, up 500% over the same time period last year. We'll talk to a reporter who says gun sales are way up too. Then, Illinois schools have a green light to reopen this fall, from kindergarten through senior year. But there are new rules, including face coverings and smaller class sizes. A conversation with teachers and school nurses about reading, writing, and COVID-19. And finally, the COVID-19 pandemic has put a spotlight on food, from how it's produced to what we eat, and for some, how insecure their access to food can be. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've got an interesting show today. Later, we're going to be talking about how the pandemic will affect the everyday experience of school when kids go back this fall. We'll also talk to an expert who's looked at food insecurity during the COVID-19 pandemic. And in a few moments, we're going to look at a surge in gun permit applications and gun sales this spring. But first, this morning, we're following another tragic shooting in Chicago in what's shaping up to be a particularly violent year. Last night, a 3-year-old girl was shot in the chest. It was an apparent retaliation for another shooting of a 15-year-old child a short time earlier. We're joined now by Catherine Rosenberg Douglas, who's covering this story for the Chicago Tribune. Kate, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So what can you tell us about this latest shooting?
It's just the most recent in a string of just outrageous tragedies. So many children have been shot recently. This 3-year-old last night about 8 o'clock in I think the 7,000 block of South Damon was playing with some other children in the yard when she was shot, and she was hit directly in the chest. Her mother found her and she was rushed to the hospital. So she underwent emergency surgery to stop some internal bleeding, but fortunately it seems to have missed her heart. And this is all information I'm getting from Andrew Holmes, who's a community activist who is sitting with the family all night in the hospital. And they believe at this point that she's stable, and they think that she's going to make a full recovery after quite a bit of time and rehabilitation.
Wow. Well, that's great to hear. But I mean, as you said, this is part of a stretch of gun violence against children that has been going on for a few weeks now, right?
It really has. There have been just gun violence in general, not even particularly against children, has been really through the roof, off the charts lately. Seems like the 28 stretch that covered most of June has been one of the worst, and I think they've said the worst since 2012.
Kate, are you still there? Okay. As we are hoping to reestablish that connection with Kate Rosenberg Douglas, we've been talking about a string of shootings in Chicago. And in a moment, we plan to move on to talk about another story she had been working on recently about a surge in gun permit applications and gun sales this spring. While we're trying to reestablish that connection, I'd like to remind our listeners, you can follow along during the show at our Twitter page, which is at 21st show. That's at 21st show. We tweet some of the things the guests are talking about, stories they've referred to, stories they might be working on. You can also find links to past segments that might be relevant to what we're talking about now. So we're going to continue trying to reestablish this connection, hopefully continue this conversation, and we'll be back with you in just a moment. Thank you. Okay, and we're back. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we have been speaking with Kate Rosenberg Douglas, who's a reporter at the Chicago Tribune. And just before I want to get on to the other story we were having you on today to talk about, which is this surge in gun permit applications. But before we move on from the string of shootings involving children, I wonder if you can just talk briefly about what does the city say, what does the Chicago Police Department in particular say about what it's doing to respond to this?
You know, I might not be the best person to talk about that.
Sure.
Because I haven't specifically spoken with them on this aspect of more. I've been talking to family.
Okay. Well, fair enough. We'll continue to follow the reporting from you and your colleagues. Our listeners can find a link to your story at our Twitter page, which is at 21st Show. Let's talk about this other story. And this is the reason we wanted to have you on today. Last week, you published a story about a surge in gun permit applications and gun sales in Illinois, tied seemingly to the pandemic and particularly the George Floyd and police violence protests we saw earlier this month. And I should say your story was about the first 2 weeks of June. We wanted to have you on a little earlier to talk about this. Unfortunately, like many newspaper reporters, you were furloughed at the time, but we're glad to have you now. So I wonder if you can just start by talking about the big picture numbers you reported on. You looked at, again, the first half of June. What did you find in terms of gun permit applications there?
Yes, so you're right. This was the end of May to the beginning of June, and just a complete spike in gun permit applications. So in Illinois, as you know, you need a FOID card. That's a firearms identification ID, and that is the first step to be able to purchase a weapon legally and to have a weapon in your possession and to be able to buy ammunition. So those permits are going to be representing, new people who have not previously had them since the last 5 years or so that the state has. I'm thinking of concealed carry. FOID cards have been around longer than that. Sorry.
Sure.
In any case, this is 500%, 501% over the same period this time last year, and there's so many different things that go into those figures, but essentially what the end result has been is 42,000 new applications in just that period that we're talking about, just a few weeks. So, and they have had days where they've had more than 5,000 people seeking to get a permit. So those are numbers essentially unprecedented, not like nothing they've ever seen before.
Yeah, and I was fascinated. You reported that the in that sort of two or so plus week time span was not far off from the number of applications for a 3 month period at the end of last year and the beginning of this year. We also saw a tweet from somebody replying to one of your links to this story earlier that said, I've been waiting since April 15th for my FOID application to the process. So, I mean, you talked to some gun store owners about what this looks like for them. What are they seeing?
They are just doing their very best to keep up with demand. One of the main reasons for this, of course, is the coronavirus pandemic. And then that is also perpetuating some of the problems, right? So you have, obviously, and somebody put it to me this way while I was reporting it, you can't shoot a virus, but that doesn't seem to stop people. And that's joking, but it makes perfect sense. Anytime there is instability and, concern about just, our most basic protection of our families, anything that threatens that concerns people, and we see, everyone's heard about the toilet paper, right? Everyone going out and buying as much of it as they can, and it's like that doesn't, you don't see exactly what the logical, thought process is there. Why do you need all this toilet paper? But it's just a concern about the supply chain, and those concerns have been borne out because they are having supply chain issues, particularly as it pertains to bullets. A lot of them are not manufactured here, and they've been harder to get.
So, you know, it's one, a contributing factor to why people are so ready to buy a gun, and then it's also making things worse.
Yeah, well, let's come back to the ammunition point in a moment, but let's stay with this idea of exactly why people might be doing this. And I should remind listeners, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Kate Rosenberg Douglas, who's a reporter at the Chicago Tribune and has reported on a surge in gun permit applications and gun sales in Illinois, at least in the early part of June. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And Kate, you talked to a DePaul University social work professor. I thought it was interesting what they had to say about this person has worked with victims of gun violence. What did he say was behind this trend in terms of, you know, the reasons that people choose to buy firearms?
I think you're speaking about Professor Noam Ostrander, and he's done a lot of work on, as you said, victims of gun violence and police brutality. And really, you know, he's saying that there are any number of reasons that these spikes in gun sales or permit applications would be normal and would be expected. Among them are presidential elections, which, of course, we're ramping toward at this point. So, you know, there was, most people understand, like with Barack Obama's election, there was a, you know, an increase. And that, you know, maybe seems more reasonable because they think, well, he's a Democrat and he's going to, you know, take our guns or those kinds of things. But it certainly they also spiked with the election of Donald Trump. So it's not tied to, you know, a political party being in power. It's and they were much less with Trump than they were with Obama, of course. But they, you know, it's any time there's what could be seen as instability or uncertainty or change. And I think Mr. Ostrander said that with Trump's election, there was a strong uptick in Black Americans purchasing firearms, and that was in response to some white supremacy rhetoric, you know. So that's one of the reasons, presidential elections, and of course the pandemic, and then all of the, you know, the Black Lives Matter and the shooting of George Floyd has really, you know, putting all of those things together, as well as the idea of defunding the police, which some people sort of misunderstand and think that means that there aren't going to be police departments anymore. Essentially, the idea is talking about redistributing the funding so that you attack root causes of things instead of sending in police to respond to that. But some people hear that and they think, you know, the response times are going to increase, or they just are more concerned than ever that there is not a protection in place other than taking things into their own hands and purchasing, you know, their first firearm.
Yeah, and I thought it was, and we've only got a few minutes left, but I thought it was interesting that, at least anecdotally, you talked to some people who thought that there was an uptick in particularly people who identify as, quote, liberal Democrats seeking firearms, perhaps for the first time.
Right. This is something that I heard from, you know, a lot of different people as I was reporting this out. David Lombardo, he's a concealed carry license instructor in near Aurora. Anyway, he said that he's had people, more than one, call and just, you know, overtly announce, look, I want to do this. I want to take a class, but do you have private classes? Can you do like one-on-one instruction? And he'll say, well, I guess, but that takes, you know, that's going to cost a lot more. Oh, I don't care. I just want to make sure that my friends, nobody knows that I'm doing this. And so what he's getting from people is this idea that they don't want, you know, that everything that they identify with and the circle and the friends that they keep, you know, would find this out of character or, you know, at odds with their other beliefs. So that's been really interesting. And some of the professors I've spoken with and the gun store owners, I should mention, also have said the same thing, that they're hearing stories from people who are just like, you know, this isn't necessarily in my political, you know, viewpoint, but I'm finally ready, XYZ, whatever it was, you know, pushed me to this point. And the professors are saying that that makes sense to them. They're saying that that's something that can happen when essentially, you know, when these major life things, they feel like people are being threatened and they feel like this is the only choice that they have.
Yeah. And we've only got about a minute left, so maybe and there's so much more to this story that's worth reading. And again, we'll tweet out a link to it at 21st Show. I would recommend people go read the whole thing because there's interesting points about the type of ammunition that's being purchased, hollow point versus target rounds, which suggests to some store owners that these are people more interested in self-defense than target practice. But you also, I just want to kind of wrap up on this idea that, you know, there are some concerns that people have about this uptick in gun ownership, particularly when you have amateurs maybe becoming gun owners for the first time. And maybe just in a few sentences, I wonder if you can talk about what the concern is there.
Right. Certainly, these are people who, again, their viewpoint may not have been to purchase a gun. And so that would suggest that maybe they haven't been around them, don't have hands-on training. And the concern is just that people are afraid and they're buying guns, but they don't know how to use them. And this is from the gun owners, from the professors. Everyone I spoke with on some level mentioned training, and the training classes that all these stores are offering are filling up because of size restrictions, because of coronavirus. And they're also worried that people are not getting the training that they should have.
Yeah, and you had a statistic in there that first-time gun owners are 8 times more likely to accidentally shoot themselves than those in gun-free homes. And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Catherine Rosenberg Douglas is a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Again, we'll have a link to her story on our website, 21stshow.org, and on our Twitter page. Kate, thanks so much for speaking with me this morning.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We're going to be talking about K-12 education, schools in an age of pandemic. What's it going to look like when the kids go back this fall? That's just after a break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Many students in Illinois will be going back to the classroom this fall, but like everything else during the pandemic, it's going to look a lot different. Gatherings will be limited to 50 people, social distancing will be required, and everyone, students and teachers, will be wearing masks. While there's flexibility among local school districts and private schools for how they implement the plan released by the State Board of Education last week, in-person instruction for children is, quote, strongly encouraged. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics also came out with a statement last week saying in-person instruction should be implemented whenever and wherever possible, writing that remote learning is likely to result in severe learning loss and increased social isolation for children. Joining us to talk more about this are Illinois Association of School Nurses President Juanita Grafinski and Gloria E. Barrera, the association's president-elect. School nurses have always had an important job, but as you might imagine, they'll be a critical part of school reopening plans in the fall. Juanita and Gloria, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks again for being here. And we're also joined by Louise Stampour. She teaches at Lincoln Middle School in Schiller Park. She's also a member of the Illinois Education Association. Louise, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a parent or teacher? You can join our conversation, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So Juanita Grafinski, I want to begin with you. You're the president of the Illinois Association of School Nurses. Earlier, we read a statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics about the importance of in-person instruction for young children and that for kids who are less susceptible to the coronavirus, the benefits of returning to school outweigh the risks. And I wonder if your association feels similarly.
Well, we do. We recognize that all students need to be in the school setting, not only to benefit from the educational perspectives, but also from the mental health perspective, in that students that are isolated often become depressed, and that leads to other problems with children, so we certainly want to get them back into the school setting. We are also aware that some families have had difficulty in engaging their child in remote learning, and so that's problematic as well. So we agree with that, and our goal is to do that safely and to do that using the processes that have been set before us by the Illinois State Board of Education and the Illinois Department of Public Health with regard to measures that were going to take place to make sure that we keep safe environments for all students.
Okay, so since we have a teacher with us, Louise, before we talk about the fall, I want to ask you and see how was remote instruction for you in the spring?
You know, it was challenging. We had a turn on a dime. I mean, one day we're in school and the next day we weren't. So there was a lot of work to get lessons prepared for online. And then there were some problems with engagement. I'm a middle school teacher, so, you know, kids wanted to sleep in. So we changed some of our times for meetings. But there was just a vast array of issues. You know, I had children who went to be with their families in Mexico. I had a child who had a very sick mother who had coronavirus in the hospital, and she was left watching a little three-year-old sister. So it was tough to have that engagement, and it certainly wasn't a regular classroom.
I wonder if you have a sense, you know, now that we have these guidelines from the State Board of Education, if you know what your classroom, you know, how it'll be set up this fall.
Right. Well, my district's still in talks about that, and they're talking about doing a blended learning, so some remote, some in person. So if we need to social distance, we can't have everyone there at one time. We just have way too many children. We don't have enough space. I'm curious exactly how that'll go. I'm a reading specialist, and we meet at tables in small groups that are not 6 feet apart. So there would have to be a new setup for that. I know the guidelines from ISB talk about having all the desks facing the same way and to be as distant as possible. It's going to be interesting. And I think schools will come up with a variety of different ways to do that.
And do you have any concerns about the ISBE plans that you've seen so far?
Well, I think it's a good start, and it does allow districts to come up with their own plans that fit that. But it doesn't really, you know, talk about how we're going to keep everyone safe. It doesn't actually have exact guidelines on how, you know, they said 50 children could be on a bus. How we're actually going to get all of our kids to keep masks on all day, because, and I'm not just saying kids, it's tough for adults too to keep a mask on for 7 hours.
Fair point. Yeah. And we've certainly seen that. And we've had conversations just this week that compliance, and at least in certain parts of the state, even among adults, seems to be going down. You know, Gloria, you're the president-elect of the Illinois Association of School Nurses. I'm sure it varies from district to district, but the state, you know, Board of Ed does have a plan with these, you know, as we just heard, mask requirements, social distancing, temperature checks. Can you talk about the role that school nurses will be playing in this?
Sure. I wanted to first say that we were involved. We had the Illinois Association of School Nurses had three nursing representatives serve on the ISBE's Reopening Illinois Schools Task Force. So we've all seen the guidance. And I think that I echo what Juanita mentioned, that we really do need to just make sure that we're doing it safely, that we're implementing these recommendations safely within our own school districts. And I think that it's up to every school nurse to really step up and have a seat at their district table. So making sure that they're part of that conversation. I'm very fortunate that I have a district that's very supportive of school nurses. And I was asked by the superintendent to serve on the reopening task force for my district. So I know that that's not the case across the state, but I think that that is a good first step that we can look at because we really are the front line when it comes to looking at the pandemic at school. We were at the front line before stay-at-home orders went into effect, and we're going to continue being on the front line when we get back to school.
And Gloria, I wonder do you have a sense of what that might look like on a daily basis? Will the school nurse be standing at the door of the school with you know, a stack of masks and a thermometer checking kids as they come in?
I'm not sure if that's feasible for every school, but I can speak to what may happen in my office. So I do have a great team that I work with. I have another nurse that I work with along with the secretary. So I believe that it would be implementing social distancing, but also seeing students that may not have a mask. Maybe they come to school without one for whatever reason. So we'll have a stockpile of masks, but also doing temperature checks if there's any concerns. But that's going to look different. And I think, you know, the key word right now is just flexibility and knowing that we have the experience and expertise to be flexible and to make sure that our voice is heard.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about K-12 students going back into the classroom this fall for in-person instruction and what that will look like. We're speaking with two members of the Illinois Association of School Nurses, Juanita Grafinski and Gloria E. Barrera. We're also speaking with Louise Stompour, who teaches at Lincoln Middle School in Schiller Park. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Maybe you have a question about what school might look like this fall. And we have been getting some comments from our Text the 21st initiative. And remember, you can join that by texting the word talk to 217-803-0730. And yesterday we asked our group, do you think K-12 students should attend in-person classes this fall? Why or why not? And we had one response from Kyle and Champagne who said, I don't think students should attend. I don't think students should attend in-person classes at any grade level until there is a vaccine for COVID. I also think a COVID vaccine should be mandatory for all students before they're allowed to go back to school. But another listener told us, yes, they, meaning kids, need contact with others and just practice common sense cleanliness and social distancing. And, you know, Louise, you've talked about sort of the challenges of remote instruction. I wonder if you can talk about that sort of socialization aspect that kids get that I'm sure you see in your, you know, students that you work with all the time. How important is that for kids?
It's vital. It's how children learn how to be adults and get along with community. Also, I expect as we go back in the fall that we're going to be dealing with a lot of trauma and mental health issues from children being alone for so long. Our biggest fear is, you know, a lot of children come from these wonderful homes and it's all great and their parents are taking care of them. But some children do not have that same kind of environment. And school is a place where they feel safe and secure and loved. And now they've been missing that for months. That's going to be tough to come back from.
Yeah. And, you know, Juanita, I wonder if you can talk about what school nurses do to address the mental health needs of students in general, and particularly this fall, as they're going to be transitioning back from so long away.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I think that's one of the most critical roles, particularly for school nurses in middle schools where I work and in high schools where Gloria works. We have seen an uptick in general of mental health concerns. And so the health office looks very different than it did, say, even 5 years ago, in that we recognize the needs of students to have a safe harbor, to come to us so that we can assess their needs, that we can be able to refer them to outside resources or internal resources within the school setting. So we're very cognizant that mental health issues have increased and that we are the go-to. I always say that I usually have seen somebody in my office before anyone else has, in many instances, with regard to mental health problems, because they understand a nurse is there to help them. And so a lot of children feel very comfortable going in there with some type of symptom that really turns out to be that they're just having feelings of depression or anger, whatever. So we know that. But we also are very prepared when we're looking forward to the school year, as we know there's going to be a number of students that have increased anxieties, stressors, home stressors, economic stressors, et cetera. So we're recognizing that. And in my district, this is one of the pillars, I believe, that we're looking toward in terms of surveilling, using assessment data. How are we going to meet those students' needs in a different way? So we're all taking that collective responsibility to identify risks, to identify if there's new risks, and then to look toward just innovative ways to meet students and talk about these things. As our reading specialist had stated, we're not going to be around that little table any longer, but that's okay. We're going to have to find a different kind of way to get around that table, you know, even if it's remote, just to talk about those things and make sure that we are there to meet those needs. So we recognize that, and we're ready to do that.
You know, and Gloria, we just heard your colleague talking about, or your, I guess, co-association member talking about, you know, the idea of mental health needs of kids. But school nurses also, I think, particularly in low-income communities, also look at other sort of more general health needs of students, right? Screening for potential illnesses or issues with things like food insecurity. Is that something that has been a concern of yours as students have been away from school for so long?
Yeah, I think it's been a concern. So as school nurses, we deliver, you know, culturally competent, proactive school health services for diverse student populations. So Brian, as you mentioned, that might be students that don't have access to healthy foods. So in a lot of districts and mine and especially Juanita's, they've been arranging for school lunch pickup. And I think that that's been great, but I think that as we go back, I think we need to just reimagine how that's going to look for our schools and for our students that may come in maybe half a day. Because again, we don't know if there's going to be full day services, full day lunch, for example. So that is something that we also have to consider. And I think that, as Juanita mentioned, we are ready to take action and to serve in any way that we can.
And Louise, I want to kind of end with you and just, we've got only a few minutes left in our conversation, but we did hear from some people with text messages who are either parents or speaking for parents, at least. Stephen in Savoy says, I see a mix of online learning with some in-person experiences. The virus is not going away soon, and we need to be realistic about the risks. Childcare for working parents will remain an issue. These things cannot be addressed piecemeal. And then we also heard from Rachel in Urbana, who said, it really depends on the state of COVID spread in the community, but I also know that parents can't work and also be full-time homeschoolers at the same time. If we aren't sending our kids to school physically, we need teachers to be on Zoom for a lot of the day with the kids to keep them on track. I know personally, as a parent, I have struggled hosting a radio show and also trying to provide some level of supervision and instruction to my kids. I wonder, you know, Louise, how you feel about, you know, that sort of aspect of this, that, I mean, teachers are really critical to getting the whole economy and the whole system back on track, because kids need a place to go.
Right. And I want people to remember, too, teachers have children. So now imagine trying to teach on Zoom while you're trying to help your students learn or try to get them to be quiet so you can talk. So it was a challenge for a lot of our teachers. It's definitely a problem. And it's not something teachers can solve by themselves. It's going to take everyone to help make this work.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is something I'm sure a story will continue to follow in the months ahead as we get ready for having kids returning to school. We've been speaking with Louise Stumpur, who's a teacher at Lincoln Middle School in Schiller Park. Also, Juanita Grafinski, president of the Illinois Association of School Nurses, and Gloria E. Barrera, who is president-elect of the Illinois Association of School Nurses, both also working school nurses. Thank you all so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be looking at, as we just heard a few minutes ago, the issue of food insecurity. A lot of our conversations during the pandemic have been revolving around food. For those of us who are maybe in a little bit more privileged position, that's involved sourdough starter and the fact that we're cooking at home more as opposed to eating in restaurants. But for a lot of people, this has really put a spotlight on the issue of food insecurity. That conversation coming up after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Many of our conversations around the COVID-19 pandemic have revolved around food. It's changed where we eat, what we eat, and even how we grow our food. It's also highlighted another issue, food insecurity and food access, especially for young people out of school, as we mentioned just a few minutes ago on the show. Here to discuss this is Chelsea Singleton. She's assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Community Health at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She has a doctorate in epidemiology. Professor Singleton, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Brian. I'm excited to be here today.
Well, we are excited to have you with us. And if our listeners would like to share their thoughts on our changing relationship with food during the pandemic, they can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So, Professor Singleton, we just heard from a teacher and school nurses a few minutes ago about kids getting back into the classroom after so many months off from the pandemic. And in their letter recommending children go back to school, the American Academy of Pediatrics wrote that school closures have had a substantial impact on food security and physical activity for children and families. So I wonder if you can talk about what kind of effects the pandemic has had on young people's relationships with food.
Yeah, definitely. So as you can imagine, you know, this pandemic has caused a substantial disruption in how we feed children across the country. You know, we in communities with large numbers of low-income children, many of the children receive, you know, at least 60 to 80% of their food or their meals daily from school. You know, we have national programs that are funded, such as, you know, we have a free breakfast program, we have the free lunch program, and then some schools in some areas actually have after school meal programs. So, you know, many of these programs are funded by the USDA, and because of the school closures, students don't have access to these meals anymore. So in response, a lot of school districts across the country, and even, you know, what we see locally in the Champaign area, they had to react and come up with emergency meal distribution systems. And many school districts across the country, what we saw, did not have plans put in place about how they were going to go about distributing meals during this time period. So a lot of it was trial and error. But now, you know, a lot of school districts, you know, they fell into a nice steady, you know, flow of distributing meals. However, we, you know, there still could be gaps in access because, as we can see, for an example, in Chicago, they're not distributing as many meals as they typically do on a regular school day. So there are potentially students who are still not getting meals. And feeding organizations like Feeding America, they're projecting that food insecurity is going to double over the upcoming months in the country and specifically among children. So it is a major concern.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that idea that in Chicago, even though the schools are trying to react, or at least most of them seem to be trying to react to this, the uptake has just not necessarily been there for whatever reason. Maybe, you know, the kids can't, you know, get out of the home during the day to get it, or the parent, I guess it's the parents, and if they're younger kids, who should be doing that? But, you know, maybe they're working or something like that. So do you know how many students are food insecure in Illinois schools?
Well, it probably maps pretty close on, actually, well, overall across our state, we have lower rates of food insecurity and poverty, slightly below the federal level, but still we're close to it. But on typically across the country, about 1 in 6 children are food insecure. And right now, I believe Feeding America, which is, you know, they are leading experts on food insecurity across the country, they're projecting that about 1 in 4 children right now are food insecure, which is very concerning. And if unemployment rates continue the way that they are, we're projecting that our overall national food insecurity rate is going to double by the end of the year. So this is a major concern.
Wow, 1 in 4 children are food insecure. I just want to pause on that thought for a moment, because that is a stunning statistic. Do you think the government is doing enough when it comes to food insecurity for kids?
Well, yes and no. That's my, you know, my answer. Typically, I try to play, you know, devil's advocate. I try to see both sides of the coin. But So, you know, for an example, you know, our programs like SNAP and many of these federally funded nutrition programs, they're all implemented at the state level. So it's up to the state to make decisions and changes. However, if they want to make changes to their operations, they have to request those changes from the USDA. So we saw lots of states, for an example, request waivers for how they are going to change how they deliver SNAP, what are the guidelines for being, you know, for qualifying for programs like SNAP. And SNAP is food stamps. That's the our the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And also with the school meals, you know, how they distribute the meals, you know, since it's not during the school, the typical school day now. So they had to request waivers to make several changes. So for an example, a lot of states, they receive waivers to increase, to allow families to get the maximum allotted, budget or the maximum allotted amount for SNAP benefits for their household size. But, you know, they couldn't, many states didn't get waivers for, you know, changing the guidelines for what makes you eligible for certain programs. So that was a big challenge. So for an example, people who lost their jobs because of the pandemic, they might have not been eligible for SNAP prior to the pandemic, but now that they're unemployed, they need programs such as food stamps. But, you know, they're considered ineligible based off of however much money they were making on their, or how much money they reported on last year's taxes. So it's a lot of challenges. You know, this is, we're trying to work around these challenges, but unfortunately, you know, we're not reaching everybody that needs to be reached.
And have we seen an increase? I mean, since you mentioned SNAP benefits, formerly known as food stamps, was there an increased need for these benefits during the pandemic?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's, you know, that's the biggest concern, that prior to the pandemic, you know, we had, you know, we typically, you know, we had our standard level of how many households are on SNAP. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have businesses shutting down. We have people who have lost their jobs. They're being furloughed. So as a result, we have more and more people in across the country and in our state who need SNAP benefits. So they're now trying to apply, and they're having to go through the typical waiting period, the typical application period. So it's prolonging their ability to get SNAP. And many states, you know, they haven't received waivers to change the application period or to change the application process. It's the typical process that people have to go through to get SNAP, and so they're not getting it quick enough. So yes, it's challenging.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Chelsea Singleton, an assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Community Health at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She also has a PhD in epidemiology, and want to invite our listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Now, one thing the pandemic has also changed when it comes to food is that we have heard more people saying that they're trying to get into gardening. We did a segment recently about the resurgence of Victory Gardens. And early in the pandemic, you also saw a lot of people sharing photos of homemade sourdough bread. You know, I wonder if when it comes to food, there are any positives here when it comes to healthier eating habits coming out of the pandemic.
Well, yeah, I definitely believe that it, you know, being at home, people are starting to cook more, which is a positive because, believe it or not, well, many people probably would believe that over 60% of the typical American diet, like the calories consumed, are from food that were prepared away from home. So most of the American diet is consumed from foods that we don't prepare ourselves. So, and the major concern of that is that those meals tend to be calorically dense. They tend to be high in fat, sodium, salt, sugar as well. So, you know, that's eating from home is definitely a positive that's probably going to come out of this pandemic.
Yeah, I would guess, though, that this maybe depends on one's economic situation, right? Being able to start a garden means you need to have the space to plant a garden. It means you need access to information about making sourdough and obviously a certain amount of time. I mean, there's like a privilege element. Do you see that as well?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely see it's a privilege element. You know, we see when we look at research around time use among families, we do see disparities across income levels. And a lot of that strongly relates to or strongly associated with adverse outcomes such as obesity. For an example, low-income families, you know, their time use is not the same as higher income families. So, you know, when it comes to planning around time and what we do throughout the day, there is a privilege that comes to that. You know, lower income families, they might, you know, you might see parents who are working multiple jobs. So therefore they can't come home and do scratch cooking or gardening or other types of leisurely activities that have been shown to be associated with better health overall. So yes, there's definitely a privilege that comes to having the time to be able to do wonderful leisure activities such as gardening, even, you know, being physically active during a time period like this. So there's definitely privilege when it comes to these sort of activities.
You know, and I was looking over some of your other research predating the pandemic, and you've studied the consumption of fruits and vegetables in terms of racial and ethnic differences, in terms of people with lower income shopping at farmers markets. And you found that there are some barriers to people, even as the SNAP program expanded opportunities for people to be able to shop at farmers markets. But can you talk about some of the barriers that people face when trying to do that?
Yeah, so I've done some work, and specifically in the Chicago area and across the state, looking at specifically farmers market use. And yeah, there are barriers to usage. And so there are some structural barriers, and then there are some, I would say, individual or personal barriers. Overall, I feel like farmers markets, for one, we have tons of them across the state, which is wonderful. We have a lot of them across specifically the city of Chicago. However, you know, all of the farmers markets are not the same. You know, a farmers market, there's a lot that goes into planning a farmer's market. So the number of vendors, the quality of vendors, how do we get the word out to people to come and use these types of programs and resources? How do we advertise that you can actually use your food stamps at farmer's markets specifically? And then also, how do we, you know, eliminate structural barriers to get people to farmer's markets specifically? And those are the things that we typically see in low-income populations. When we survey them and do interviews or focus groups, many of them don't know about the farmer's markets in their community. They don't know that they can use the food stamps. Also, they are also really concerned about structural barriers, such as how do I get to one? Is it a safe area specifically? So there are many things that can create barriers that result in people not using farmers markets.
And we've only got less than a minute left in our conversation, but I wonder if you can just talk about what are some options for people who may not have access to fresh fruits and vegetables right now?
Yeah, so if you don't have options, or if you don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, then, you know, if you're trying to make sure that you consume an adequate number of fruits and vegetables, then I would say try to find specifically frozen options, or maybe consider going to an emergency meal distribution site, or even someplace like a food pantry specifically. But I'm always an advocate for frozen. More and more smaller food stores across the country, specifically places like CVS, dollar stores, they have frozen fruits and vegetables. So I would say that would be a better option. I just try to tell people to, you know, kind of stay away from as much canned and shelf stable options as possible, which you can typically find in any store. Even gas stations sell canned fruits and vegetables. The reason why I say stay away from the canned stuff is because they tend to be very high in sodium, very high in preservatives. And, you know, sodium is, you know, it increases your risk of high blood pressure, diabetes. And, you know, those are two major causes of death and disability in the country. So I would say, you know, think about staying away from the canned stuff, but consider frozen options or going to emergency meal sites.
All right, fresh if you can, frozen if you can't, stay away from the cans. Good rule of thumb there. Professor Chelsea Singleton teaches in the Department of Kinesiology and Community Health at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Professor, thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Brian.
And that is all the time we have for today. Our program's produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan's our engagement producer, and our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.